Welcome to the Computing Darawas podcast. I am your host, Richie Bilak. Today, I am speaking to Kitty Munson-Cooper. Kitty is a bit of polymath. She is a systems programmer, web developer, world-class bridge player, and a genealogist. I hope you will enjoy the conversation. Hi, welcome to the Computing Darawas podcast. I'm your host, Richie B. And today I'm speaking to Kitty Munson-Cooper, someone who I've known for a long time. She's a bit of polymath, as you'll find out. Hi, Kitty.
Hi, Richie. Yeah, I'm an accidental programmer.
The first question I always ask is, how did you get started in computing and kind of when? What happened?
I met my first computer in 1967. I was doing a summer program at Brown University for science students. You see, I was really good at math, science, and art. So I thought maybe I should be an architect. So I took a summer program in engineering. And the first thing they had us do was learn Fortran on this IBM 3650, which took up a room larger than my whole apartment now.
Yes.
It means this giant thing, and there was this little teletype thing. So you had to type in your programs, and then you could print them out on paper tape and bring them back the next day to work on them. So that was, and I just really, really took to it. I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, oh, this is fun. And I did a lot of that in between playing bridge in the dorm. So
bridge. That was in high school and college?
This was high school. I was in high school. It was before my senior year of high school. I'm sure my mother wanted me to fill out my resume to make sure I got into Harvard, the family school. So in those days, it was Radcliffe, and that was super important to her. So, you know, I went along with it. And this was a great experience. I had a wonderful time. I loved Brown. My heart's broken right now, but I really loved it there.
Right.
In fact, I applied. That was kind of a safety school for me when I applied to college. Anyway, it was wonderful. I loved it, and I didn't think anything of it. Freshman year in college, they had this general studies program, so you had to take something everywhere. So I thought, oh, there it is, Introduction to Computing. That'll be a gut. I'll take that for my science requirement. And sure enough, it was super easy for me. I've since discovered that people like me who are really great at geometric proofs were really good at the kind of programming we did back then, which is like logical step-by-step stuff. So that's how I always checked when I was interviewing people how they liked geometry in high school, because that was my favorite part. I adored proofs.
Oh, that's funny, because I also did really well in geometry in high school, and there was a teacher who, she taught geometry, and she really helped me to kind of get into calculus and all that other stuff. So a lot of my career path, I kind of, is thanks to her. So this was when you went to college. This is Harvard already?
Yeah, I was at Harvard. I was a freshman. I had to do a science requirement. Mm-hmm. So I took NatSci 110, which was Introduction to Computing, and learned a few more programming languages. Like,
what did they use?
Well, we had teletypes in the basement, pretty much like what I had at Brown, that went into a giant IBM computer. Oh, yeah. My favorite story about me in college is, you know, other girls, there are these hooks on the back of your closet door where you could hang scarves and purses and things. Mm-hmm. You come to my room and it was paper tapes.
So that's funny, because I use punch cards, but I guess you use paper tapes, which was...
I never had punch cards till much later in my working career, and I was sort of shocked by it. I thought, boy, this is antediluvian. Yeah, that was at Chase Manhattan. I was really unimpressed, but no, paper tapes, that's how I stored my programs. And I wrote a program called to do Red Dog to play poker with me. Poker was another way I supported myself in college. Being the
That's
only girl
funny.
In the game was a big edge. But I still
what was your major?
Anything of it. I majored in so many different things, anthropology, archaeology. I ended up with fine arts, which is history of art, because I fulfilled most of the requirements. One of which was my junior year, I took a course called Computers for Artists, which sounded like
fun. Oh, interesting.
And this guy had this PDP-11 in his lab. And he took all these artistic types and taught us how to program assembly language on the PDP-11. Okay?
That is pretty funny.
So he comes in one day when I'm in the lab, and I have all these squares and circles dancing on the big screen, and he was blown away by how good I was. You know, and I developed all these subroutines, and, you know, to me, it just came really naturally, Richie. I never thought anything of it. And by then, I changed my plan. I didn't like the Bauhausian approach at Harvard. So instead of being an architect, I was going to be an animated filmmaker. And so I was doing this animated film on the computer. Anyway, I might have been accepted to CalArts, or I did a delay. I couldn't go for a year because I needed to make the money. Mm-hmm. My money from my grandparents had run out. And so I had to make the money. And so I looked around at jobs, and I could have worked for Sotheby's for half the amount that I could work at this digital OEM startup. So next thing I knew, I took a job as a systems programmer because I knew the language on the PDP-11. And our product was a language called MUMPS. And our big client was the Mass General Hospital. And MUMPS was this cool language which integrated a database into the language.
Right. I've heard about it. I've never actually used it, but I've heard about people using it.
It was a good little language because it integrated a database right into the language. So it was particularly good for medical records and stuff. And as usual, I was the only girl in the systems programmer group. There were plenty of girls over in the applications programmer group. And I didn't think anything of it because I was used to being the only. But I had these wonderful MIT guys who were teaching me the trade. I mean, I felt like I was being paid to go to grad school in systems programming. And we also played bridge at lunch. Have I come back to that theme a lot? And but I loved it. And so pretty soon in the spring, I got a letter from CalArts that they were closing their grad school. So I couldn't go there. And I really didn't care anymore. I was really happy programming. And then my company was bought out by a company in Princeton.
In Princeton, wow.
And so AHS, I think, Automated Health Systems. And so I had 6 months pay, and I didn't have to, you know, I could still hang out in Cambridge. I went down to the Boston Chess Club where they played bridge. And I played rubber bridge and backgammon, and I was having a high old time. And this guy who worked at Digital Equipment had his eye on the Route 128 Bridge League trophy. So he was recruiting programmers who played bridge.
Oh, that's funny.
So he recruited me to come work. He also recruited Bart, my current love.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now Bart was one of my early bridge mentors. I was a really talented young player. And being one of the few girls who was good at the game, I had plenty of handsome young male partners.
Right. Can you just, for people who are listening to this, can you just in 25 words or less explain what bridge is?
No. Bridge is the chess of card games. It is a card game that involves partnership, strategy. There are two parts of bridge, the bidding part where you get to a contract and the play part where you try to make that contract. And then both of those have a competitive element, and your opponents are trying to thwart you or make their own contract. So it's a partnership game, and it's incredibly – the people who play it are pretty smart, but most of them are kind of, on the spectrum. We're all on the spectrum. Okay.
Yeah, well, I did play bridge too, so
– although not at your level. Do you think it
– Yeah, that's good.
And it's a trick-taking game like hearts – or spades, but they've added all this stuff to it that makes it incredibly interesting. You never master it. No matter how good you get, you're never a completely master of the game. You're always learning. And that's what makes it a game people like to keep playing.
Right. That's making it, interesting. Yeah.
You see lots of new stuff. And I remember being a systems programmer at AHS, we didn't have things like debuggers. So I had to put zeros in my code so it would stop at the appropriate places so that I could figure out what was going on. That's how I debugged back then. And the other thing...
So explain. So you put zero in your code to make it crash and do a dump, produce a dump or something?
No. There are these switch registers on the front of a PDP-11. So I would fiddle with them and look at where everything was, and then I could make it go again from where it
left off. Oh, I see.
Okay. So I never dump printed stuff. Who needed that? I mean, in those days, I could look at an octal number in a binary number and know the octal number and know what right. that was. But that was then.
Yeah. So what kind of, when you say systems programming, do you know what operating systems you were doing on PDP-11s?
We had no operating system. What are you talking about? We were writing the operating system. The operating
well,
system.
Which one? Which system was it?
Mumps.
Do you remember? Oh, Mumps.
There
okay,
was
I
no
see.
Operating
okay.
system. We were the operating system. That's what systems right. programmer means. You're writing the operating system. I've worked on a few operating systems since. I remember some friends who I worked with at the Bank of New York. I would send digital corrections to their operating system because I'd find some bug that was a timing thing, you know, because we were doing these really, we were at the leading edge.
Right.
So anyway, I left digital to get married to a brilliant bridge player who lived in New York. Bart was at that wedding, my current man.
Wow. Small world.
We've been friends 53 years. So wow. anyway, in New York, the cutting edge programming was all these banks were getting into electronic funds transfer. And right. that was the new cool thing. That was really cool. And I worked at Chase Manhattan for a while, and that's where they stuck me with punch cards. I had to write my code out on a pad, and that went down to the typing, the people who typed up the cards, and then you had to run the cards overnight and get the app. I mean, I thought this was all really antediluvian. I was used to working right on the computer. But within a year, we had CRTs, and we could work more directly. But that was all Fortran, as I recall.
Oh, interesting. I kind of got started in a similar way when I started at Irving Trust Bank. I was working on punch cards, and the thing is, they had key punches, so I key punched the stuff myself.
Key punch operators, right?
Yeah, but within a year, there's a part of the bank that got PDP-11s to do, you know, funds transfer stuff. So I transfer immediately because they had terminals.
No
I didn't want to deal with cards.
Well, I was working on PDP-11s, and they were still trying to put it into this old model of key punch operators and cards.
Right.
But
right.
during my time there, they finally caught on to the modern world and got us CRTs.
Yeah, the bank I worked at, the CTO there came from IBM, and he thought that programmers should not have terminals because they would just type instead of think about the programs, which we thought was the most ridiculous thing you ever heard.
yeah, I often regretted I didn't take typing in high school, you know, because I'm still sort of I'm just a fast hunt and peck typer, but
yeah,
never learned proper typing, and you have to type all the time when you were a programmer.
So what kind of systems were you doing working on at Chase?
Electronic funds transfer. I don't remember what our underlying, I mean.
Well, I'm sure it was not like IBM 360 or 370 or something.
No, no.
But was it?
PDP-11s.
No? Oh, PDP-11s. With punch cards?
Isn't that unbelievable?
Yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable. But soon we got CRTs. And I wasn't a systems programmer then. I was working on the application. But I was actually a consultant. I worked for a consulting company. And mm-hmm. I did a couple of other things while I worked for them. But then I missed the camera D of digital, of working
right.
with other smart people and working with people like me. So even if they weren't female, they, you know, had weird minds
yeah.
like mine. So I went back to work for digital. I went to work in their field office in New York, and I would
oh, cool.
go out with salesmen and, you know, explain stuff, and then I'd get the project, and I wrote some really cool code. I wrote some code for a guy at FIT. I wrote some code for a guy doing process control down in New Jersey. I had a really fun time, and I had cool people I worked with, most of them quite smart.
What kind of process control? What sort of stuff was that?
Well, as I recall, it was I'd had to write a driver for magnetic tape. Mm-hmm. They didn't have such a thing.
Right.
And then we were loading stuff into trucks that would back into these cubby holes and get the right stuff loaded into them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was neat. And they had a programmer there who did most of it, but they were having trouble with their tape driver, so I had to rewrite it. That's my memory. The other thing I noticed in my early years of programming, though, is scientists couldn't handle programming because they couldn't handle the fact that the code wouldn't run the first time, that debugging is part of the process. They expected what they wrote to just work. And that's not the way it happened for most people. Of course, for me, it did a lot, but that's another story. Or why they threw me into the big bin of printouts, because I was bragging. I'd written 20 lines of code, and it worked the first time. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, debugging is part of the process.
Yeah, that was my culture shock when I first started taking computer science and programming in college. Like, computer science 101 was easy for me, so anytime I wrote the program, when it's compiled, it worked. Then I took data structures course, right, and my first program compiled, but it produced wrong results, and I had no idea what I was supposed to do.
Exactly. I mean, it was like such a shock. So, you know, I learned how to, you know, put in print statements. What I often would do with my program is I'd have a variable called debug. Uh-huh. And if it was turned on, then all kinds of print statements would come out. So I could
see
how everything was going the whole way through. I still use that technique.
Of course.
I write occasional tools for myself and for people who follow me in PHP, because I can put them on my website easily that way. And it just runs so nicely. But these days, I mean, in the old days, you had a misplaced comma in your Fortran statement and it would throw the whole thing off and it took you forever to figure out. Now, they have syntax checkers online. So I just cut and paste my code into the syntax checker. It tells me what's wrong and I fix it, and it usually runs.
Right.
That's just makes such a difference having that.
You'd be surprised how much print statements are still used in all kinds of systems. It's amazing to me that people don't use debuggers as much as they can. And they, of course, there's places where you can't really use a debugger. So if you have some code running in some server somewhere and you need to debug it, you do precisely what you said. You have a flag that says turn debugging on, and it dumps a whole bunch of printouts.
Exactly.
To logs.
Exactly. In fact, in some of my code, I could put a slash debug as input to the program, and that would... It would get that as a, it would know that it should turn on the debugging statements. But yeah, I wrote a debugger for Fortran once. I mean, the purpose of a debugger was to let you put breakpoints in the code and let you look.
Right, exactly.
But I don't think people have the, I don't think they use them anymore. I don't know.
Well, people use debuggers. Oh, debuggers certainly exist. It's just for some reason people don't use them. So it's like, you know, it's so weird when you program in some modern language. And you say, oh, how do I debug this? Or use print statements, really?
Yeah, it's like we're going back to our roots here. I don't have to store my programs on paper tape anymore.
Right.
There was a wonderful story, I don't know if it was apocryphal, about a PDP-11 that when you loaded up the operating system, some days it just didn't work. And that's what we did. We loaded the operating system from a paper tape in the early days.
And it turned out
it was when the sun was hitting the paper tape reader at a certain angle. So on a sunny day, it didn't load. Yeah, that was then.
So how long were you at Digital in New York, Dina?
I think I got my 10-year pen, but they may have been including my previous years. I got pregnant with Paul while I was working for Digital. Uh-huh. And I went out on maternity leave. I had a terminal at home at one point. I was out on that was later, and that was for a bank. I did have to go in a couple of times while I was on maternity leave for various meetings, but they were really generous with me because I, you know, and when I had Paul, my worldview changed. I said, you know, I can't work 60-hour weeks anymore. If you want me to come back, I'll work a 30-hour week, or, you know, I won't come back at all.
Right.
So they said, that's fine, because I wanted to go home at lunch and, you know, nurse my child.
Yeah, yeah.
He was really important. I had a full-time housekeeper. I mean, I had a good job. I had a full-time housekeeper, but it was just so interesting watching this little creature grow and change.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was almost as interesting as my work, although I did have a feeling that, like, oh, my God, take me back to the office.
you probably have a little more control of a computer than the child.
Then, yeah, it was, he was a very difficult child at various points. And I can't believe he turned out so well. But yeah, I went back after maternity leave, and it was, you know, I just couldn't work the way I had before. And so I decided to become a consultant, and I had Digital's blessing. I took some of those clients with me who I'd written code for, and I continued to do work for them. And I did work for a company called Loral up in the Bronx somewhere. And
so that's an interesting actually question, right? So this is an interest, but you'd like an independent consultant?
I was an independent consultant. By that point, my husband had a pretty high-powered job, so my salary wasn't as critical, but I was making way more money and working far less hours. And I enjoyed it, but then
the question
to England.
Well, before we talk about England, can I ask you, how do you go about becoming independent consultant? So I guess you develop all these contacts while you work in Digital, so it was pretty easy. Yes.
Yes, but also the guy up at Loral who hired me was a consultant I'd worked with back at Chase when they tried to make me use punch cards.
Right.
So he knew how good I was.
So it's basically networking, yeah.
It's basically networking, and as I recall, I went to a lot of Deacuses too back in the day, and you know, that was a DEC user society thing, and I had some papers at Digital. I mean, people knew who I was, sort of. I mean, I was talented female programmer. I don't know. It was networking, not feeling the pressure of taking a job I didn't want, but there was always work somehow.
Right. I always tell people there's plenty of work to be done. So
yeah. And it was a lot more fun being a consultant.
Why?
Because I worked fewer hours and made more money. The work wasn't always more interesting. I remember I had one job where I was working on analyzing radar over Germany.
Oh.
And there was a lot of math. I had to consult with my husband, who was a terrific mathematician, to figure out how to do some of that. And I was stuck doing it in Fortran too, and the different bands. It was really kind of interesting. Yeah, a lot of the work, I'm sure it's been unclassified by now, but I had to get a
security clearance.
Right.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. No, it was interesting work. I mean, defense work can sometimes also be state of the art, you know?
Right.
Banks. You wouldn't think of banks as being state of the art, but that whole funds transfer thing, it just brought them into a new era, a new way of doing things. It was really fun.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the stuff that I used to work on. You know, I tell people I worked at a bank and I wrote device drivers, which is not something you would think you would be writing at the bank.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, I remember what happened then. I was just getting started as a consultant when a guy I'd worked for back in Boston recruited me to come to, not Bank of New York, Bankers Trust.
Uh-huh, right.
Okay. In fact, he did end up at Bank of New York as well. But anyway, Stan Rose was my boss way back when I started, and he recruited me, and the temptation was 5 weeks vacation and you'll be a assistant vice president and have all these benefits, right, and you won't have to work 60-hour weeks. And okay. So that was really fun. And I remember I was working on a problem that was happening in Singapore, but I didn't get a trip there. No, I just had to start work at midnight so I could monitor it. And then I'd meet my husband on the station at 8, because by then we'd moved to the suburbs. And he'd give me the car. He'd tell me where he parked the car, and he'd go in and I'd go home. It was really amusing. It was a spooler issue with over in Singapore, but I didn't get the trip. But I did solve it. One thing that happened is somewhere along the way, I was an ace troubleshooter. And I don't know if it's because I made all those mistakes myself in my youth, or I could just smell what was going wrong. It's hard to explain. But I was good at figuring out what was going wrong, even when it wasn't my code.
I guess after a while, you kind of, if you create enough problems, you develop an intuition where things go and how things can go wrong.
Yeah, I remember one time the data center called me at like 3 in the morning And I said, apply the PC solution and send me an email because I won't remember this conversation. What is the PC solution? Reboot. Fixes everything.
Right.
And of course it worked. But
of course.
Yes, because we built those systems to be incredibly resilient.
So you said you wound up in London at some point?
Well, yeah. Well, I was having fun working at the Bankers Trust, and my husband got transferred to London. Mm-hmm. And Bankers Trust was willing to transfer me as well. But the package he got paid for private school, housing, you know, things that my salary used to cover. So I decided my husband said, Henry, he said, you know, you're only going to keep 10 cents on the dollar. There's no point. You're working. Now, by then, I had a Pro 350 at home. That was a PDP-11 repackaged as a personal computer.
Okay. I vaguely remember those.
The president of Digital said, why would anyone want a computer on his...
Yeah. Right.
So they were late getting into the game. But I did buy a Pro 350, which was a PDP-11 package for the desktop with floppy disks at Dekus, I guess, at a discount. And I brought it home. So my son, Paul, probably cannot remember life without computers because he had a Commodore 64. I had the Pro 350. I mean, we were a very computerized household. And his dad would leave him little stuff on the Pro 350, little math things to do. And it was, and we had something called DataTrieve, which was my first database language. And I wrote a thing to do my checkbook. So, you know, I could balance my checkbook. That was really fun. I really enjoyed it. So I took it with us to England and it was up in the attic. So if I needed a programming fix, I could go up there and play. But mainly I played Rubber Bridge because at that point I realized I could be really, really good at bridge. I was really, really good. I made the British women's team.
Uh-huh.
That was an exciting point in my life.
Didn't you also win like the world championship at some point?
When I came back. When I played for Britain, I won a common market mixed teams championship, and we were third in the European women's. So, you know, I had some accomplishments, and I won plenty of tournaments in England. I even wrote a program to deal hands so I could practice bidding. There are better things out there now, but back then that was my main interest. So then when we came back, things weren't going so smoothly with me and my husband. Well, the selectors for the British ladies team told me that smoking was hurting my endurance. So if I wanted to make the team, I had to give up smoking. And surprisingly, the next day, I gave up smoking. It was really hard. I tried so on and off for 10 years. So
it's funny. I never remember you seeing you smoke. So
no, well, I didn't. When I came back,
right?
This was back in England. My husband Henry promised that after I'd given up for a year, he would quit also, and it was clearly hurting his health.
Right.
So we came back, and I decided to go back to work because I figured, you know, if he doesn't give up smoking soon, I'm not going to stick around. I can't live with this. So I called up a few people I'd worked for before, like Stan, Anna, and this guy I'd done a lot of work for at Bankers Trust, who is now at Bank of New York, and his named Richard Pace. Now, I didn't know he was in charge of the entire programming department when I called him up. I just, you know, hey, I'm back. So it was a hiring freeze was on in a lot of places at the time, apparently. But his thinking was, ooh, we got to get this brain under our roof. So he sticked me on you. And you probably were a little bit discouraged with how little I knew about modern whatever or my different approach to things. But we had a fun group. Jack.
We did have a very fun group, yes.
And Steve. And it was a great group. I really enjoyed all of you. And
well, we enjoyed you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Anyway, after 2 years, he was still smoking, and so I moved out. We remained really good friends, You know, we both parented our kid fine. Everything was fine. And I liked him so much better when I didn't have to live with him. He never gave up smoking, and it did kill him a little bit early. But anyway, that's life, you know? You make choices, you live with the consequences. You like smoking better than me. Okay. Smoking is your friend. And addictions are so hard, Richie.
Yeah.
Nicotine is one of the most addictive substances. I can't tell you all the different ways I tried to give it up until the select, you know, apparently Bridge was the best motivator. I wanted to be on the team.
Yeah, my father used to smoke when he was very young, but he at one point he gave it up, and then, like, he was in his 40s, and he lived to be 95. So.
Well, my mother lived to be 85, and she smoked like a chimney and drank like a fish and abused all of her prescription drugs. But I will tell you, one of her sisters lived to 94 and the other one to 100, so she probably did knock 10 years off her life.
So I know at Bank of New York, we got into Vaxis, right? So we went back into digital, but not PDP-11s anymore.
Oh, yeah. I got into Vaxis already back at Bankers Trust.
Okay.
We had Vaxis and PDP-11s, and I was in charge of the mini tech support group there. Mm-hmm. And I was already writing code in DCL. That's the command language. I wrote procedures for operators. And we had this one operator, we called him Mickey. His name was Mickey, who was so awful that we would have him test all of your code. As if it was Mickey-proof, it was good. Anyway, but we were all very fond of him. He was a sweet guy, but he, you know, didn't have it all there. So a Mickey-proof procedure. So, yeah, so I did a lot, but I also taught. I mean, I was sort of like, I had a group. I never wanted more than three or four people. At one point at Bankers mm-hmm. Trust, I told my big boss, no, I don't want 11 people reporting to me. Promote these two guys and have them head up different groups and, you know, get me back to two or three people so that I can still code. And that was always been my problem, was trying not to move up. Trying to have an important job, but not have so many direct reports. I never wanted to stop coding. That was just, I loved coding.
Right. I mean, I've done the same thing. I always tell people when I got to a fork in the road where they said, do you want to move into management or you want to stay technical? I always went the technical part, you know, I want to. And when I was at Google, I got to actually step back. For a while, I was like a team lead / manager and decided I don't want to do that anymore. So I at least let you step down.
Wow. Well, people thought I was nuts to like promote two of my people to take most of my people away. But, you know, I was so much happier after that as I was getting to code again.
Right. That's probably more important.
Yeah. I even got a letter many years later from one of the new young kids out of college who was working for mm-hmm. me, thanking me for mentoring him and teaching him his trade, basically. But, you know, that's what the guys did for me, the MIT guys did for me back at my first job. So,
well, it's nice to teach people. So,
yeah, I like teaching people.
That's the best way to learn, actually.
Exactly. So I know, you learn more when you try to express what it is you know.
Right. I know that at Bank of New York, you build like a system for doing software releases. Remember that? No.
Yes, I did that. I think my biggest accomplishment at Bank of New York was there was this program that was crashing all the time that was written by Liz McPadden, someone in Liz McPadden's group, and nobody could figure it out. Rich Ludwig wrote a nice thing to get a dump because, you know, we didn't have those.
Right.
And every time I'd, you know, do a half hour around lunchtime every day for weeks. And it took me forever, but I figured it out. And it was your bugaboos. It was a global variable problem.
Okay.
The person who'd written the code thought they were using a global variable to get the stuff back from whatever device, but they were using a local variable. So what was coming back was overwriting the code.
Nice.
It made me think of you, Richie. It was a, because you were so adamant about global variables.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when I called Liz and I said, this is the problem. She didn't believe me. And she went in and she said, oh, my God. By then, the data center was running two or three copies. So, you know, it didn't impact performance because of, right, like everything else, our code was robust. If it crashed, yep, everything kept working.
So what happened after Bank of New York?
Bank of New York. Well, again, I got the yen to be out on my... Well, when I was at the bank, the other thing I really enjoyed was I got a summer intern in. Mm-hmm. And I went to my big boss and said, you know, if you give me a summer intern, I can get all of our documentation, internal documentation, online on the internal internet. That was one of my favorite projects. So they got me a summer intern, and we got all the internal documentation online on the internal internet, and I learned all about HTML and all kinds of web stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I really loved that stuff.
So
I decided to go out on my own and make websites.
Right. So what is your little company called?
Open Sky Web Design.
Yeah, I'll put a link. It's still I know the website is still up, right?
Yeah, I keep the website, and it has a resume, but I haven't updated it. And it basically says, I'm retired. I don't do it anymore. I have two or three clients I haven't gotten rid of. I've gotten rid of most of them. And when I had a horrible accident in 2010, and my brain didn't work for about 6 months. So I had an associate who had done a lot of work for me, and I basically gave her all my clients. We were using a content management system called Joomla and WordPress, those two. And I just gave her all the clients. And she just took care of everything while I was out, basically.
Now, I'm curious, so how did you get started? So you decided, you know, to be a web designer and start this company. Did you have any clients lined up when you started? Or?
No, I did some volunteer charity websites so that I could have something to give my resume. What it was is, you remember in 2000, there was a huge run-up of bank stocks, every stocks, and I was dating a Wall Street guy at the time, a trader, and I read in his Barron's that if your 401k was in company stock and you pulled it out, you didn't have to pay real taxes. You only had to pay, I forget the term for it, but it suddenly occurred to me I had all this goddamn money tied up in Bank of New York stock. And if I pulled it out, I could live on it for a year and reinvent myself.
Nice.
So that was my plan. And I gave up my apartment. I gave it to my son, who was coming to New York. And I had a ski place up in the...
Vermont?
In New York, near Wyndham.
Okay.
A little condo. And I spent a lot of time there. But my parents had some major health issues. And I had to take so much vacation to deal with it. You know, I was out of vacation, and it was May. My dad had a quadruple bypass, and my mom was catatonic. She couldn't deal with it, so I dealt with it.
Right.
And so I spent, I was living out with them a lot of the time and dealing with them. So
right.
I didn't have to work for about a year. So the first order of business was taking care of my parents. And then meanwhile, I was building charity websites, you know, website for, by then I was deeply into genealogy. So I built a website for the International Jewish Genealogical Society's collection of Jewish cemeteries all over the world.
Oh, interesting.
They had all this data, and I rebuilt it into a Joomla site. And it's beautiful, and it's still there. And I recruited people to just cut and paste the information. You know, to be Joomla editors, you don't have to be a programmer. Cool thing about content management systems is you get an interface that's an editor, and you don't.
Right. I've used WordPress a bit, but
it's you know, the separation between the display, the stuff where you have to know web, and the content where you don't have to know web, is terrific. And I usually put new clients on WordPress. But I also used something called CMS Made Simple and Joomla, and that was kind of what my business was. And I think I did a couple of – I was also a master gardener. I worked on their site. I did some charity sites. My first paid consulting job, I loved gardening. I went up to Santa Fe, was with High Country Gardens, and they wanted a program to do this and that. And they balked at my rates. And I said, well, I'll take 25% in plant credits. and so we struck a deal. And I built a beautiful garden from that. But
oh, nice.
It was like the first, it was really fun because I wrote code that went out on the web and collected stuff for them. And that was the first time I'd written code like that. And I really enjoyed learning how to do it. I mean, I think that's one of the fun things about programming is learning new ways of doing things.
Right. There's always something new to learn. So that's kind of like bridge, right?
Yeah. There's
never ending.
My latest program, I wrote a little program to go out and scrape the a website that has the used Wordle word list and analyze the frequency of letters in every position. And then gives you a little display and shows you, well, the most frequent letter is E by a lot.
Right.
It's E-R-A-T-O-C-L-I-S. Anyway, those are the most frequent letters. And it shows you not only the frequency total, but the frequency for each position. And some letters like S are incredibly frequent in the first position. Y is very frequent in the last position.
That makes sense.
So I had a wonderful start word for a long time, but it got used. And, you know, I don't want to use a word that's been used because then I can't get it in one. Bart complained bitterly the first time I got it in one. I screamed and said, oh, no, I've lost my start word. I've had it in one three times now, so it's painful. But I tried not to scream that the last time. I didn't completely see. So, and the other type of program I write now is for genealogy. I have a number of programs that manipulate CSV files that have genealogical information. I wrote a program that takes something called an Onentoffel list, which is a list of all your ancestors in a certain format, and turns it into a GEDCOM, which is the format genealogy programs want. So you can take the one and turn it into the other. So you can, it makes your genealogical data extremely portable.
So yeah, so that's actually leads me to this question. What are you working on now? What are you doing now? Right, you retired from your web business and you just write code for genealogy stuff for fun?
No, I don't write much code anymore. Actually, what I do is I help people with unknown parentage cases. I'm a genetic genealogist. I'm an expert at the type of DNA testing you should do to figure out your ancestors and your parentage and all that stuff. And it really was accidental, again, that I got into helping people. It's mainly because a lot of the men on my Munson side seem to have done a lot of straying. So I have cousins, you know, and if they're my cousins, I'm not going to charge them, you know. I've got to figure out who done it, you know, where was the break on their tree. So, and that's how I got started And I'm very disappointed that I don't have any half siblings. But, you know, and I met all kinds of cousins in Norway because of my work with genetic genealogy, because they had tested early on at 23andMe. And I stayed with some of them when I went to Norway on a long trip. And my dad was Norwegian American. His dad was born in Kristiansand. And his mother was the child of two Norwegian immigrants. They all lived in the Norwegian section of Brooklyn.
Which was where?
I don't really. Ovington Avenue was, no.
Oh, okay. So that's Bay Ridge. Yeah.
Yeah, Bay Ridge. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I lived in Bay Ridge for a while.
Ah. Well, it's not so Norwegian anymore. And then on my mother's side, my mother was born in Munich.
Oh, okay.
And her father was Jewish. And her mother was Catholic. And they had a 9-year courtship before both families caved. Actually, part of it was he was at the front in World War One, you know, doctoring, because he was a doctor. And he didn't want to move, you know. And his wife said, no, we got to get out of here. And he said, oh, this will blow over. And his wife said, I don't like. She finally pulled the trump card, right? She said, I don't want my daughters growing up in this environment. So he said, all right. Because he had offers from universities all over the world. He was a very prominent doctor, medical professor with his own clinic in Freiburg. He was a big deal. So they went to Tufts Medical School. That's where he went.
So the one question I try to ask everyone is, if you were talking to somebody who's trying to get started in the field, in the computing field today, what is your advice, if any?
If you didn't like geometric proofs, try something else. Follow your heart. Do the stuff that interests you. Don't do programming just because you'll get a job. Take courses. I mean, when I was in college, I took all kinds of wacko courses, Dostoevsky, computers for artists, archaeology, apes. You know, just follow your heart and it'll come to you what you should be doing. But don't become a programmer just because you think there are jobs there. If you don't love it, do something else.
That's actually good advice. So the other question was, you are a woman in the field that is very male at the moment. Now, I don't know if you know this, but the very first software engineers were actually six young women who programmed the ENIAC. There's a wonderful book about them called Proving Ground.
I'd love to.
Yeah. I'll send you a link to it. It's fantastic.
And, please do. My nephew asked me this question. He said, well, you know, was it difficult being a woman? I said, at the beginning, if you were green and could do the work, they wanted you. I mean, there weren't enough programmers to fill the jobs. There weren't enough people who had the talent. So it didn't matter. And by the time it mattered, I was too far along. You know, I was pretty high in the hierarchy or whatever. And I was so confident and sure of myself, it never occurred to me that being a woman was a problem. I was used to being the only woman, you know, in my poker game, in many of the bridge games. I mean, it was okay. You know, it's just that's how it was for me. And I never worried about it. I never thought the first time someone tried to treat me as a second-class citizen because I was female was when I was at college. And I went to an all-girls school, so we were imbued with the can-do philosophy that we were just as good as the boys. We never thought about it, you know?
Right.
I never thought about it till college. And the first time I hit a bit of that discrimination, I basically looked at the professor and laughed at him.
Excellent.
You know, it's like, uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I took a course in game theory. I remember that one. Economics. Awesome. It was a grad course in economics from one of the great minds in game theory. And I did take it pass fail because I thought this might be a little hard for me. It's a grad course in economics. I loved it. It was great. That's where I learned about, you know, the prisoner's dilemma and
right.
So, and again, I was probably the only girl, but I just didn't even notice it anymore, Richie.
When I started working, there were plenty of women in various positions, and in my career, there was a number of years where my direct manager was a woman.
Right,
and it was just fine, you know. So I had no problems. Google is probably there's not quite enough women.
There were plenty of them at the bank, and they were all very good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I never, you know, for me it was never an issue, but I didn't even notice it really, except for in college once or twice. Right. And I just didn't put up with it.
Good.
It just, you're kidding.
Right. Yeah, let me fix your code here.
Yeah, exactly. To some extent, at least back then, programming was a gift, and I didn't recognize how gifted I was. It was just something I could do. And I remember I was half an hour late to the final exam, and I left early. And I got everything right, of course.
Of course, yeah.
That was NatSci 110. That I told you it would be a gut. that introduction to programming when I already knew Fortran. Right. But I loved it. I just loved it, and I never thought about it being my career until I had to make money.
Yeah, I think I kind of stumbled into programming also because I had to take science courses when I was in college and physics got too hard for me. So computer science was a science.
Right, exactly.
So figure would count and it turned out to be easy and fun.
Yeah, exactly. So how did you decide to work in the field?
It's just connections. It's like I knew somebody who worked at the bank, and they said, well, they're looking for programmers. And I interviewed, and Well, my funniest story about that is when I was at Brooklyn College, there was a professor there who was developing a test to test for aptitude for programming.
Mm.
And he tested his test on the computer science students. So this bank I went to, they said, well, we have this test we give to see if you have aptitude for programming. And that was the same test. So naturally, I scored off the charts on it.
But. Of course. Yeah, I remember IBM used to have something like that way back in the day because they were trying to get people to come and program for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, today I've done quite a bit of interviewing and I tried to coach students how to interview, but the current technical interviews are just terrible. They're not really reflective of what your job is or if you're able to a job. So anyway, all right, so this is great. So we talked for about an hour. That'll make a perfect podcast.
We covered enough ground here.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking your time. And
it was wonderful to spend time with you, Richie. I really enjoyed it. And of course, I love, some of my memories of early programming.
I'd love to hear
the zeros
in
the switch register on the front of the PDP-11. Hi.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to our listeners and, we'll see you next time.